Your Honor, at this point, the plaintiffs have called Dr. Stephen running to the witness stand. Your Honor, for purposes of the record, during Dr. Running's examination, we'll cover Exhibit P20, Target Atmospheric CO2, Where Should Humanity Aim? Exhibit P22, The Young People's Burden, Requirement of Negative CO2 Emissions. P71, Western Fire, Weather Days Increasing. P72, Camouflage Mismatch and Seasonal Coat Color Due to a Decreased Snow Duration. P73, Dramatic Declines in Snowpack in the Western U.S. P79, Heat Stored in the Earth's System, Where Does the Energy Go? P143, The IPCC Sixth Assessment Report, Summary for Policymakers and Synthesis Report. P164, the attachment to Dr. Running's expert report of the sources that he considered in preparing for his expert testimony here today, and Exhibit P193, a copy of Dr. Running's CV. May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
Please state your name.
Stephen Aran.
Where do you live?
Missoula, Montana. The climate system as clearly and concisely as I can, includes the energy balance and imbalance, the physics of greenhouse gas and emissions that are driving climate change, the global carbon cycle, global hydrologic cycle, how they control this energy imbalance, and then how human-caused fossil fuel development is harming Montana's ecosystems and the hydrology.
Now, Dr. Running, did you prepare your expert report in this case with Dr. Kathy Whitlock?
At Montana State University.
Did you, between yourselves, divide up the topics you would each cover in the expert report?
Yes, I'm trying to make this as organized as possible. We decided that I would cover, we might say, that the fundamental physics and the global scale data stream that we have, and that Dr. Whitlock would concentrate on the Montana material, and particularly material from the Montana climate assessment that she's senior authored.
And did you and Dr. Whitlock prepare a rebuttal report?
Yes, we did.
And generally, was that to rebut the expert witness report of Dr. Judith Curry?
Yes.
Now, Dr. Running, let's hear why you are qualified to testify on the topics you've just identified. I'm going to ask you, do you have your binder in front of you?
Well, no, I don't.
Okay. Well, you have a CV that was marked as Exhibit P-193. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yes. And, Your Honor, I understand there's no objection to Dr. Running's CV.
No objection.
So 193 is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, Dr. Running, can you briefly provide the court with your educational background, starting with college?
Yes, I had a bachelor's degree in botany from Oregon State University, and then a master's in forest management, also from Oregon State. I then went to Colorado State University for my PhD work in forest ecophysiology. I came to the University of Montana in 1979.
Is that your educational background?
Yes.
Okay. So can you explain what forest ecophysiology is?
Really trying to study the ecology of an ecosystem, particularly from the point of view of the physiology of the plants themselves that are in that ecosystem and how they react to the environment.
Now, to save time, we would stipulate that Dr. Running is qualified as an expert to testify on the topics they identified.
Thank you very much, but I think it would be helpful for the court to understand his background so that he can...
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Dr. Running, you were... when I interrupted you about to explain how you came to the University of Montana, can you briefly describe your work history?
Yes, I was hired as an assistant professor in 1979 and primarily to teach tree biology and forest ecology. And I was there for my entire career and retired as a regents professor in 2017.
And while you were at the University of Montana, did you have what I'm going to call a primary area of research?
Yes, even though I was trained in tree biology, I got invited in 1981 by NASA to start trying to think through global scale ecology. And at the time, NASA had no ecologists on its payroll anywhere in the country. And so they were struggling to get a sense of how can we measure ecology at the global scale in any way. And so my tree biology work ended up kind of being sidelined by hanging out with the rocket science crowd.
And can you explain what your work was initially with NASA?
Well, what I've ended up doing is literally taking tree biology to the global scale. I wrote the algorithms to process Earth system satellite data, and specifically my data set calculates this sounds kind of arcane, but global daily photosynthesis of the entire terrestrial biosphere and evapotranspiration.
Now, in layperson's terms, can you translate? What does that mean?
That basically means that my data set calculates the initial carbon uptake by the biosphere, literally absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere and putting it in plants. And the evapotranspiration part is measuring particularly the status and drought stress of the ecosystem.
Now, we see a reference in the slide that's being displayed to NASA's Earth Observing System. What's that?
This is what we conceptualized starting in 1981. And it was called the Mission to Planet Earth at the time. And we designed this concept of an Earth Observing System. And this was then funded by Congress, and the program started in 1990. And so the cornerstone were three major satellite platforms, and they're up there to this day.
So what we're displaying right now, NASA's Aqua satellite, is that one of the platforms you're talking about?
Yes, there was a Terra, an Aqua, and an Aura satellite, and each of these had a number of sensors on board the satellites. So they weren't single purpose at all. They had 6 to 8 different sensors on board.
And when you speak about your work, were you doing this work and getting funded from NASA through the University of Montana?
Yes, I was on grants and contracts from NASA through the University of Montana.
And briefly, what is our nation through these satellites measuring with the satellites?
Well, we're measuring every aspect of the climate system that's amenable to remote sensing. And when we think about the climate system, we separate it in obviously the atmosphere, but also the oceans, the land, and the cryosphere. So there's basically 4 major components. Across these 3 satellite systems, we have a variety of data products that people just like myself at universities around the country and the NASA centers wrote similar algorithms to measure sea ice and sea level and a number of other attributes of the climate system.
And you earlier alluded to this data is used by governments all over the world?
Yes, from the beginning of the mission, the goal was that all these data sets would be open and freely available to the whole world. And so we have people in probably every country on Earth using these data sets.
And is it your understanding that the state of Montana itself is using these data sets?
I think they're now using my satellite evapotranspiration algorithm for the drought monitoring.
Okay. Now let's turn to some of the committees that you've been on. Have you served on any committees?
I'm afraid so.
Can you describe the types of committees you've served on?
Yeah, briefly, and starting from the most recent, I'm currently a co-chair of the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Earth Science and Applications from Space. Before that, I chaired the Earth Science Advisory Committee for NASA Earth Science Division. As I go down the list, at one point I chaired the Land Working Group of the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which that's the big climate model team for the country. And so I chaired the land part of that. At the international level, I was on the executive committee of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program for many years and the World Climate Research Program, particularly the Global Terrestrial Observing System, of which our EOS was part of that system.
By EOS, you mean
the Earth Observing System, yeah.
Thank you. And you talked briefly about the National Center for Atmospheric Research as having a climate model. Essentially, what's a climate model?
Climate model is an attempt to put all 4 of those components that I listed before together in an interactive, dynamic way. And these are now some of the biggest intellectual efforts of humanity that's compared to the Human Genome Project in terms of complexity of trying to understand, measure, and project forward the global climate system. And NCAR there in Boulder is one of the climate modeling teams in the U.S. There's 6 of them at major universities and NASA and Department of Energy centers.
Dr. Running, we're going to run into a lot of acronyms in this case. And one of the acronyms is NOAA, N-O-A-A. What's NOAA?
That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And what we, most of us recognize more is it's where the daily national weather forecast comes from. But they also do climate science over longer terms.
And is that a data source that you rely on?
We feed our data to them, so it goes both ways.
Dr. Running, have you authored any books or peer-reviewed publications on the topics where you're going to testify about today?
I've authored two books, and my last count of publications is something north of 300.
And as a result of your work, not only with the EOS and with forests and the like, have you been blessed to receive any awards?
Yes. It was given the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Technology Pioneer Award in 2009. The NASA and U.S. Geological Survey PCORA Award in 2015. My daughters really love this one, ISI, the World's Most Influential Minds, for 3 years. That was their title, not mine. And then finally, probably the most notoriety is as part of that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2007, we shared the Nobel Peace Prize.
And so let's spend a little time talking about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. Briefly, what is that?
The IPCC was established in, I think, 1988 by the United Nations, and it was tasked with five to six-year intervals providing a formal assessment of climate science at that point. It's organized to three working groups. Working group one covers simply the physical science of climate and the related factors. Working group two evaluates the impacts of that climate on various systems. I was in working group two. I was author for the North American chapter of working group two. And then working group three is evaluates adaptation and mitigation options for working with solutions to climate change. And that's working group three. Okay. And up till now, there have been six IPCC reports. The most recent. These reports are so big that they don't come out all at once. Working groups, IPCC six came out in pieces from 2021 to just a few months ago, the final synthesis report in 2023.
So let's, because we're going to be referring to these reports throughout this case, I believe it would be helpful to the court to understand the process before you get to the synthesis report, the process of just preparing a report.
Yeah. Each country is authorized, each country in the United Nations is authorized to send authors to each of these reports. And so these authors are selected from their scientific community and meet as an author team. Our first, in effect, marching orders is that we're to read and evaluate and assess the peer-reviewed climate literature from the scientific journals. It's important to recognize IPCC does not do any new research of its own. It's also important to recognize that IPCC explicitly is not allowed to make any policy recommendations. They can evaluate policy alternatives, but it can't make any recommendations. And this was drummed into us as offers from the very beginning.
And so you had the role of, I believe, what you called the lead author.
Yes, I was a lead author for the North American chapter.
And what, and can you explain what that means in terms of your role?
My role particularly was to cover ecological topics, and that included hydrologic topics, and as it turned out, wildfire was the biggest part of, at that time, of my material that I put into the chapter, because it was the very first time we had scientific literature definitively proving that wildfires were accelerating in the world.
So while the IPCC was instituted by the UN and the World Meteorological Organization, does the United States government have a role of participating in these reports?
Every government has a role of participation and also in review. And so when we wrote the first draft, or we, and all the, at each reporting stage, when the authors write a first draft, it goes to open formal review. Anyone, literally anyone, can write review comments to the IPCC report and draft. And then we as authors were obligated to consider and respond to every one of these reviews. Now, this included reviews by national staff of governments throughout the world.
Including the United States.
Certainly.
And then the review process, it results in, would you say it's a pretty voluminous report?
I know ours was 2,000 pages long and across the three working groups. And I wonder if any human has ever read the whole thing cover to cover all at once.
So what we're displaying here in the slide, these are all titled synthesis report.
Right.
Can you explain to the court what a synthesis report is?
Sure, and probably best to just give my experience. I probably read 200 research articles to make my contribution, and I think all other authors equally the same. From those 200 papers, as I remember, I ended up using specific material from maybe a dozen. And so I had to choose absolutely the most critical papers that illustrated the most important new discoveries of climate impacts on ecosystems, and use that for my assessment. So literally, we as authors were not just simply doing a literature review, but we were assessing the value and importance of all the papers we read, and then highlighting the ones that were most critical.
And going back here to the highlights, it talks about chapter lead author of IPCC report. So,
yeah,
essentially did all the for the 2007 report, were the lead authors recognized? I'll start again. Sure.
Yeah.
So, in terms of the IPCC recognition in 2007,
right?
The IPCC report lead authors were recognized as part of the Nobel Prize. Is that
right.
Correct?
Yes, correct.
And that included you.
Yes.
And then we've talked about the IPCC assessment reports. Another thing displayed on this slide is the United States National Climate Assessments.
Right.
And first off, how do the U.S., the National Climate Assessments, differ from the IPCC assessment reports?
They followed a lot of the same protocols, but certainly it was targeted just to the United States alone and more targeted to our socioeconomic activities. But and I think they worked very hard on some explanatory graphics that even with the latest report, you can go on the website and they have very, very good interactive graphics and the national climate assessments. They also had chapters on regions of the country. So along with topic areas, there was also a Pacific Northwest region and a Midwest region and et cetera, where there was more focused detail on each region and the issues involved with in each region.
And did you have any role on any of these national climate assessments?
For the 2014 report, I was the convening lead author for the forest chapter.
And is that essentially a role similar to what you played in the 2007 IPCC report?
In effect, it was maybe one step up because I was the convening author for the chapter. And then in the IPCC report, I was one of about a dozen authors, as I remember, in the North American chapter.
Now, on the slide here, there's five reports, but there's a fourth national climate assessment. And then there's a climate science special report. Can you explain what that is?
As we've learned more and more about the entire climate system and have more material to look at, and a good example is that NASA Earth Observing System, we now just have incredible amounts of information now, and the research literature on climate change and impacts has just exploded in the last 20 years. So we find more and more where we special reports need to be targeted to distill and assess topic areas that 20 years ago we didn't focus on in quite such a way.
And now, Dr. Running, of these reports, did you, in preparing for your testimony here today and in preparing your expert report and rebuttal report, primarily consult any specific reports?
Yes, because my purpose here is the larger scale science. I read in detail the sixth assessment, we call it AR6, that the first part, the physical science working group one, came out in 2021, and then working group two and working group three somewhat later. And then they had the synthesis report in 2023. The other primary report at the national scale is then the most recent national climate assessment in 2017.
And Dr. Running, we've talked at the international level, we've talked at the national level. Have you done any work on reports for the state of Montana?
I was part of that report back in 2007 where the governor had convened a committee to look at issues for Montana, but I was not part of the Montana Climate Assessment. Dr. Whitlock led that, and that was right as I was retiring.
Now, you mean 2017 was it?
Yeah,
you were retiring.
That's right.
Have you studied the climate change impacts on terrestrial ecology in Montana and the West?
I think our first paper was in 1991, where we did a simulation with the forward projections we knew at the time to see where Montana forests and particularly Montana hydrology was going to go into the 21st century. So that was our first paper. And been lots of other ones since.
In terms of your testimony here today, are you testifying as a global climate change scientist?
Yes.
And are you testifying as an expert in state energy policy, for example?
No.
Do you believe that your testimony will be helpful in assisting the court and understanding particularly the scientific evidence of this case?
I think so.
Are you charging the youth plaintiffs in this case?
No, I'm not.
In preparing your testimony for this case, did you consult any resources other than the ones we've identified already?
Along with these assessment reports, certainly the Montana Climate Assessment of 2017 and the companion Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment are by far, for me, the best look at where Montana's climate is going right now and forward projections. So those were what I relied on mostly for looking at Montana-specific details. Although I'm not covering so many, much of that because Dr. Whitlock did.
Your Honor, at this point, I would offer into evidence as part of their expert report, Drs. Running and Whitlock listed all the sources they consulted. I just informed counsel prior to Dr. Running taking the stand that I'd be offering that in. So we'll meet and confer about that later if I may just raise that with the court now.
Okay.
So, Dr. Running, in terms of your testimony as to the climate impacts of Montana, is that based on well-established science, in your opinion?
No, absolutely. There's a long history of the climate change science.
In your opinion, Dr. Running, is there any doubt that these climate impacts in Montana are happening?
No.
And in terms of where you get your sources from, where are they, for example, data measurements? Where are you getting your sources from to determine that climate impacts are happening?
Combination of some of the direct data sets that my team would work with when I was still on the faculty. And then reading the research literature, I continue to read relevant literature in the major journals.
Is there any doubt in your mind, Dr. Running, that the climate impacts you will discuss in your testimony today are the result of human-caused or anthropogenic climate change?
No, I see no doubt.
Dr. Running, when you prepared your expert reports with Dr. Whitlock and reached the conclusions there, did you base those conclusions on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes, and in fact, particularly with the IPCC reports, they have very carefully formalized the language of representing the degree of certainty of every topic that they cover. And so that's something that in the climate science literature has been very methodically defined and used.
And in your testimony today, will you answer my questions using that same reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
I will attempt to.
The defendants kindly agreed that we could admit Plaintiff's Exhibit 302, which is the attachment of citations to the expert report of Dr. Running and Dr. Whitlock, and I believe it's the next exhibit is 302, and we'll include that in the binders at the end of the day.
All right, Exhibit 302 is admitted.
That is correct, John.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Running, let's get right to the point here. In your expert opinion, are the young plaintiffs in this case living in a destabilized and dangerous climate system?
I think our climate science clearly has established that our climate is now unstable because we've imbalanced critical parts of the climate system, as we'll talk about in the next few slides.
So in your opinion, is human-caused climate change harming these young Montanans?
It's harming all of us, including and especially these young people.
Without going into lengthy detail, looking into the future, in what key ways will human-caused climate change become even more harmful to these plaintiffs?
Yeah, so when I started giving climate talks about 22 years ago, actually, and thinking about Montana and trying to really distill all sorts of details into kind of the bottom line, the most obvious bottom line is that our landscape is going to become more arid. The temperature is warming up, and yet we're not getting more water to go with that. As it warms up, two fundamental things happen. The winter time is getting shorter and the summertime is getting longer. And as that summertime gets longer, this is when our growing season droughts get worse. And then the final thing is when wildfires get more wild than we've ever seen.
Will the severity of the effects of climate change get worse over time?
As long as we keep emitting fossil fuels, it'll keep getting worse.
Now, is there anything, in your opinion, that Montana could do to stop the effects of human-caused climate change?
I think Montana, and really everywhere else, needs to, as rapidly as possible, quit burning fossil fuels. Really quite straightforward.
And does that also apply to things like leasing, fossil fuel extraction?
It doesn't matter to the atmosphere where it's burned. It can be burned here or it can be burned the other end of the planet. It all ends up in the atmosphere and is mixed all together in a matter of weeks. So it really doesn't matter where. It's if.
So, Dr. Running, let's turn now to the science of climate change and how long we've known about this problem. Can you briefly explain what I'm going to call the history of the climate scientists, how long scientists have understood human-caused emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are causing warming of the Earth's surface?
Yeah, it's really a remarkable history that as far back as the 1850s, scientists had figured out that certain molecules, just by the structure of the molecule, would allow shortwave radiation, which is sunlight, through, but would trap the long wave or thermal radiation. And when we call it a greenhouse gas, a greenhouse is a perfect example. The sun comes through the glass, and then the thermal radiation cannot get back out, and it gets hot in the greenhouse.
And was early work done on that by certain scientists?
Yes, and so I guess to finish the long history, Svante Arrhenius is usually given credit for actually putting two factors together. First, he acknowledged the earlier work that these molecules have this greenhouse gas property. And then he recognized that London and Britain was starting to burn a lot of coal. And he just matter-of-factly thought, gee, I bet if humans burn coal long enough, it might actually make the planet get warmer. And he got the Nobel Prize in 1896 for that deduction.
And prior to Arrhenius, had others been doing work in this area?
Others have not put that kind of those two factors together, but there were certainly other scientists that had figured out pieces of this issue. Arrhenius has really given credit for figuring out the final big picture that we're living through today.
And what work did Eunice Newton Foote do in this regard?
As I remember, she did some of the early work of just beams of light through these gas columns, and then being able to measure that these greenhouse gases absorb the thermal radiation.
And so this is kind of like a greenhouse or like a windshield in a car. Is that correct?
Yeah, or a car sitting out in the sun, as we all experience.
Now, what were the CO2 levels back when Eunice Foote and Arrhenius were doing their work?
They didn't know. They literally didn't know. It had never been measured in any meaningful way that the outside atmosphere. So they didn't have a good idea what the global atmospheric CO2 was.
And did eventually come up with a way to measure that?
Well, not until David Keeling in the 1950s. So we went a half a century from Arrhenius's conceptual thought to where we started being able to actually measure it in a precise enough way.
Now, in the slides we have here, we have a number, 280 for Eunice Foote, for Arrhenius, 295. And right after that is PPM.
Right.
What's PPM stand for?
PPM is parts per million.
And what does that mean?
That literally means if you have a million parts of atmosphere, which is mostly nitrogen and oxygen, you then have a part, or in this case, 295 parts of CO2 with a million parts of the atmosphere.
Well, a million parts per million sounds small.
Yeah.
Can you explain why it has consequences?
Yeah, I think a good way for us to think about it is think of other substances that in very tiny amounts are critically important. And the one we chose to get to show this is thinking of arsenic, that at 0.01 parts per million, arsenic is an increased cancer risk. So this is true of many things throughout our lives. The very tiny quantities that sound incidental, in fact, are not incidental and even lethal.
So let's pick up where you were going with Dr. Keeling. When did scientists start monitoring greenhouse gases?
The immortal Keeling curve. I'd have to say this has been considered the most important geophysical data set of the century. This is how significant this is, because Dr. Keeling figured out a brand new way of measuring atmospheric CO2 with a wet chemistry that had never been done before. He worked at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, La Jolla. And he wanted to then, once he realized he had a measure that seemed very precise, he wanted to measure the background CO2 of the world and not have it contradicted by local CO2 sources. So that's why he went out to Hawaii into the top of Mauna Loa. That was very carefully chosen to be as close to a background as you could get for this CO2 measurement. And he started the measurements, and he told me later, he started in 1958. He told me by 1965, they knew what was up. So there'd never been any evidence CO2 was going up. Nobody had any idea. But he said within maybe 7 years, it was clear it was going up every year.
So he told you, you knew Dr. Keeling?
Yes, he had. Turns out Dr. Keeling's family had a little ranch down in the Bitterroot, only about 40 miles from the university campus. And so Yeah, I got to know him quite well.
How'd you meet him?
Imagine this. You're a little assistant professor sitting in your office, and the world's most eminent geophysical scientist walks in your door. And I've never forgotten it. It was, needless to say, quite imposing. And yet he was just the most regular guy there was. And so he had been reading about my early NASA work. So he had figured out who I was. I knew who he was, but I had no idea he was in Montana until he showed up. So we co-authored papers together over the years and had lots of interaction.
And did he do some of his research in Montana?
A little bit. He took some carbon isotope measurements near his ranch. He never did the atmospheric measurements because you have to have the whole chemistry set up to do the final measurement itself.
Now, at what level of parts per million in 1958, when Dr. Keeling started doing his measurements of CO2, were we at?
Well, as you see in the curve, we were at about 315.
And where are we now in terms of atmospheric CO2 levels?
About 424. And I'd like to add at this point is, once it became clear how important this data set was, there are now dozens of places around the world that take the identical measurement. So we know atmospheric CO2 in the South Pole, up near the North Pole, we know it all over the place. And so this has been replicated many times. And so it's hard to pick an exact single number that's worldwide because there's a little variability.
But if you had to give a number, where would you give that range?
Right now, it'd be about 424, I think.
And so in between 1958 and today, we've essentially added 100 parts per million.
Yes, yes.
And in the Keeling curve, if you look at it, there's little red ups and downs. Can you explain what those ups and downs are?
Yeah, this for me as a terrestrial ecologist was the most interesting of all. We were able to figure out that is the seasonal dynamic of photosynthesis of the entire northern hemisphere, drawing down the CO2 by a few ppm. And then in the fall and winter, in the dormant season, a lot of that CO2 is released back. And so we literally, that's the first measurement of global photosynthesis. They beat my data set by 40 years.
So in the graph we have now, we have 316 is the beginning, 422 at the top. In the middle, we have the figure 350 parts per million. What's that figure for?
Well, a number of the science, and particularly the modeling teams, the climate modeling teams and the carbon cycle modeling teams, tried a few years ago to evaluate what level we have to get back to restabilize the climate. And just to go right to the punchline, they came up that we need to get back to 350 in order for climate stability to be achieved.
And in your opinion, Dr. Running, what's the primary cause of atmospheric CO2 rising so quickly?
I think I find this to be a real interesting shortcut to all the details. And it's simply this. It took 200 million years for the world to, generate the fossil fuels, oil, coal, gas. Took 200 million years. We are digging it up and burning it in 200 years. So we have just in balance the global carbon cycle by a factor of 1 million. And that's what we're in the middle of right now.
So You talked about burning CO2. Where does the CO2 go?
Yeah, this is my favorite one-slide summary of global carbon cycles. And it basically a group, it's called the Global Carbon Project. They put this out every year, and they assemble all the statistics and attempt to figure out the mass balance of where this CO2 is going. So we've just been talking about the fossil fuels there, and that's 89% of the source. Notice it's 35 gigatons of CO2. It's worth understanding that there's about 11% of additional CO2, human-generated CO2 is lost by the wildfires, agricultural burning, deforestation, things like that. So then the other side of the ledger is where does it all go? We now know quite accurately that about 26% of it is dissolved into the ocean water. 29% is taken up by the terrestrial biosphere. That was my box in this. That's where I worked. And then the final 48% stays in the atmosphere, and that is specifically what the Keeling curve is measuring, is that final 48% that stays in the atmosphere.
So just to restate, the sources of human CO2 emissions, that's fossil fuel burning and land uses.
Yeah, land use change.
Yeah, can you give some examples of land use changes?
Well, as I said, not only deforestation, but agricultural burning, wildfires, and prescribed fires. All those are emitting CO2 from human management. So we, in attempting to understand this entire balance, we also, in this work, try to quantify that component of it as in, to evaluate how it is compared to the fossil fuel burning. And clearly the fossil fuel burning is 10 times as large.
And in terms of where it goes, when you say it goes into the ocean, what do you mean by that?
It literally dissolves chemically into the water. And it's just like the soda pop you drink, is dissolved CO2 in liquid. So the ocean continues to take up some of the CO2.
And biosphere, how does the CO2 go there?
That's the photosynthesis that I worked in. The CO2 is taken up by green plants, and we all learned this hopefully in junior high biology that the leaves absorb CO2 and make plant matter out of.
So with reference to the Keeling curve, what's the rate at which atmospheric CO2 is rising each year?
If you look down in the beginning, it was about 1 parts per million per year. And what you see as you look carefully is that it literally is accelerated over the last 50 years. First to around two parts per million per year, and now up to 3 parts per million per year. And so it's continuing to accelerate up.
Now, is there any scientific consensus on what is causing this rise in atmospheric CO2?
Yeah, at this point, there's really no controversy in the formal literature at all.
And what is that scientific consensus?
That, number one, climate change is real. The Earth is warming up. And that the driver for this is burning fossil fuels.
And do you know any reputable science body that disputes this at all?
No, most developed nations have some level of a formal science body for their nation's science. And I think every single one of them in the last 10 years have put out official statements recognizing the reality of climate change and the causality of fossil fuel burning.
So I'd like to orient that point a little bit in this litigation. When the plaintiffs in this case started the case, they filed a complaint. And in the complaint at paragraph 7, the complaint reads as follows. The threats posed by fossil fuels and the climate crisis are existential. Science is unequivocal that dangerous climate change is upon us and is occurring due to human activities, primarily from the extraction and burning of fossil fuels. And then in response to the complaint, the defendants file an
objection, Your Honor, irrelevant. We have an agreed fact that covers this point, and this isn't it.
If I may make the point, Your Honor, and then I'd ask the court to argue the objection, because I'm still in the middle of making the point.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'm going to overrule this objection. You can go ahead.
So in the defendant's answer, the state of Montana denied the allegation in paragraph 7. And do you, Dr. Running, have any way to explain the denial of the statement in paragraph 7?
No, the physics in this issue is really unequivocal.
I'd like to talk now about CO2 levels. I'm going to call it rising over time. Now, how does the burning of fossil fuels by human activities compare to natural cycles throughout the Earth's history?
Yeah, what we're looking at here is looking back 800,000 years. Most of this information they actually get from measuring CO2 in ice bubbles. And it's actually a very clever technique that they found to do that. So they can then make ice cores in Antarctica and places and find out that this is the CO2 level over 800,000 years. Now, what became clear the minute they started doing this is that there's some cyclical dynamic there that all sits between what I like to call a natural envelope of about 200 to 300 parts per million. And a guy named Milankovitch in 1912 figured out what caused all these. And it turns out it's eccentricities in the orbit of the sun, wobble of the earth on its axis, and he calculated this all by longhand while he was in prison. And we still talk about it 100 years later. It's so unbelievable. But he nailed that this cyclic cycling of CO2 was simply the cyclic nature of these orbital dynamics. Now, the two other factors that are worth us understanding when we look over a longer history, the two things that really trigger climate surprises are volcanoes, big ones, way bigger than we've ever experienced in human history, and then the other one, meteorite strikes, and probably all the dinosaur aficionados know that the meteorite stories. So those are the two things that over historic time bounce CO2 around. But you see, it sat within that natural envelope until this last 100 years.
So what a natural envelope, you're talking about where the red line bounces up and down.
Yeah, it's staying between about 200 and 300 until now you see it shot up to over 420 just in the last 50 years.
So, Dr. Running, we've been talking about carbon dioxide levels driving climate change. To understand warming, do we also have to understand energy units?
Right. Yeah, and this is where it really can get thick. And when I start jumping units, I sometimes get myself confused.
Okay.
So we'll hang on.
Well, let's see if we can.
Let's see if I can get through it.
So there's a term, Earth's energy imbalance.
Yep.
Briefly, what's meant by the term Earth's energy imbalance?
Well, if we think of the energy budget of the Earth like our checking account budget, we have income and we have outgo. And in the case of the climate system, scientists have worked hard. The incoming part is actually pretty easy. It's solar radiation from the sun, We have satellites that measure that above the Earth's atmosphere. And then, of course, all sorts of measurements on the ground. And then we evaluate reflected radiation and then the emitted thermal radiation from the surface. And you add and subtract all those pieces, and you end up with a look at the energy balance, or in this case, imbalance. It's really the foundation of the physics of global warming.
Now, we have displayed on the screen three papers that are marked for exhibits as P20, P22, and P79. But generally, are these papers, we'll go into them and I'll identify them further as we go along, but are these the authoritative papers on this issue?
These are certainly some of them, and I would say the climate scientists have been quite busy. There's a lot of papers. These are some of the most prominent, but by no means the only ones.
And the first two are, first one, target atmospheric CO2, where should humanity aim? That's a paper where the lead author is Dr. James Hansen, correct?
Yes.
And then the next paper, Young People's Burden, requirement of negative CO2 emissions. James Hansen's also the lead author on that, correct?
Correct.
And heat stored in the Earth system, where does the energy go? The lead author there is Katrina von Schuckman. Do you consider these three papers among the most authoritative?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, I think we're going to turn to another graph here, and we're going to talk about what the whole issue of what is happening in the Earth from a heat content standpoint due to atmospheric CO2 rising. Can you explain where the heat's going?
Right. And recognize these are in energy units, not in temperature. We will look at that later. But what we now really understand quite well, and I'll emphasize, this is based on measurements, not on a computer model, that the greenhouse gas trapping of the last 100 years has been trapping this energy, as we've looked at conceptually. Well, now this is hard numbers of how much energy has been trapped over what time period. You see the graph starts at 1970 and then where it's going. And by far, far and away, 90% of this additional heat has been and is continuing to go into the ocean. And you see the land and atmosphere is a pretty small sliver of the climate system when we see these energy units.
And from 1971 to 2018, did the Earth gain energy?
Oh, yeah, that's what we're seeing. It's almost comical to look at the number 360 zeta joules. And you can see there that's 360 and 21 zeros. We tried to relate that to something we can get our head around. That is 11 billion times larger numerically than the national debt of $31 trillion. And add another 11 billion to that and you're up into the zeta joules. It's a number that just blows your mind.
And you also worked on another way to explain this in terms of Flathead Lake.
We've tried. It's such a number hard to relate to. We finally figured out approximately if you were to boil off Flathead Lake about 40,000 times, that would be above what 360 zeta joules of energy would do.
And has the Earth's energy imbalance been worsening in the past 10 years?
Well, it's worsening every year as fossil fuel emissions continue to go up.
And what's the primary driver in Europe? opinion of Earth's energy imbalance?
Well, it's really back to these basic physics that as we add these greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, as they continue to trap this radiant energy, radiant energy from the sun and trap the thermal energy, it's just continuing to build more heat up in the climate system.
And to your knowledge, is there any scientific uncertainty about this fact?
Well, there's no alternative explanation at all.
In your opinion, Dr. Running, is it important that we correct the Earth's energy imbalance?
Objection. Yes, because at this point, we don't know when this is going to end. At our current trajectory, it's still getting bigger. And if we don't stabilize this, it's hard to know where the planet will be in another century or so.
So how, in your opinion, do we correct the Earth's energy imbalance?
By not burning fossil fuels anymore.
And will that stabilize the climate?
Once we bring the atmospheric CO2 back to 350 parts per million, that will be the point that we think the climate would restabilize. The energy budget would then be in balance.
And is that the best available science as of today?
Yes, and that's been calculated by a number of teams that come to that same general order of magnitude.
So, Dr. Running, we earlier referred to the paper, Target Atmospheric CO2, Where Should Humanity Aim? When was the standard of 350 parts per million first established?
Well, I think this Hansen paper was the first one to actually finish a complete calculation that could withstand journal review. And you see, this was in 2008, so it's been 15 years ago.
And what was Dr. Hansen's job at the time he published this paper? Do you know?
He was the head of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies in NASA.
And I'm going to read the language into the record here. If humanity wishes to preserve a planet similar to that on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted, paleoclimate evidence and ongoing climate change suggest that CO2 will need to be reduced from its current 385 parts per million to at most 350 parts per million, but likely less than that.
Yeah, I'm going to object belatedly to reading from a document that's not admitted into evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I'm happy to offer this document, P20, as well as the other two documents papers that I referenced into evidence, and that those would be P22 and P79.
Now, Jack, on the basis of hearsay, Your Honor, these are hearsay.
Well, I understand that, but he relied on them, I believe.
And they're learned trees, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm going to admit 20, 22, and 79.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Dr. Running, is that the 350 parts per million standard that you referred to earlier?
Yes.
Okay. And does that standard, in your opinion, hold true today?
Yes. No one has come up with any different target than that.
And it would certainly hold true if PPMs are above 420.
Yes. We dream about the good old days when it was 385.
And in your opinion, Dr. Running, purely from a scientific perspective, is correcting Earth's energy imbalance what's needed to protect Montana's clean and healthful environment?
Yes, I mean, quite simply.
And is it the standard necessary to protect plaintiffs' ability to live clean and healthy lives in Montana?
I think so.
Okay. I'd like to turn now to the von Schuckmann paper. And the von Schuckmann paper states the earth.
They have a continuing objection to all of these treatises as yes. being hearsay.
Yes.
The von Schuckmann paper states the earth energy imbalance, or EEI, is the most critical number defining the prospects for continued global warming and climate change. Understanding the heat gain of the Earth system, and particularly how much and where the heat is distributed, is fundamental to understanding how this affects warming ocean, atmosphere, and land, rising surface temperature, sea level, and loss of grounded and floating ice, which are fundamental concerns to society. Dr. Lennon, do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do.
Now, how do we bring CO2 levels in the atmosphere back down to 350 parts per million or lower?
Well, if we refer back to the Keeling curve, we see that it took 140 years to rise 70 parts per million from 280 to 350, and looking also at the ice core data. And in that period of time, the Earth warmed about 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, this last 35 years, we've risen another 70 parts per million. So you look at that level of acceleration, and we've gone from 350 to 420 in the present time, and the Earth's warmed another 1.3 to 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit just in these 35 years. And so what we're seeing now from the simple temperature and atmospheric chemistry is the kind of acceleration that the Keeling curve represents. And of course, now what we're really seeing is the manifestation of this energy imbalance in all sorts of heat waves, wildfires, storm and hurricane systems, glacial retreat, all the impacts that we'll hear more of are really in these last 40 years starting to come to pass. This is no longer a future possibility, but we're now living right in the middle of it.
So in your opinion, Dr. Running, what happens if CO2 levels stay where they are or keep rising and we don't return to 350 parts per million in this century?
It's pretty clear that all these extreme events are going to happen more frequently and in greater magnitude in ways that we can't predict it ahead of time in many cases. So these can end up being very harsh surprises that we may be in for in coming decades if we don't start to rebalance the climate system.
And is that the opinion shared by the IPCC assessment reports and the U.S. National Climate Assessments?
Yes, every one of them.
So, Dr. Running, can you explain what effect the continuous rise in atmospheric CO2 has had on air and oceans?
Okay, now recognize we just shifted from energy units to temperature. And so I'll try to keep these things from getting crossways. Now what we're looking at is simply the measured temperature anomalies from the long-term average is the y-axis there. And what you see is particularly since 1980, we have not had a single year below average. Not a single year. Every single year is above average, more and more and more. And in a stable climate, you would expect in general about half the years above average and half would be below average. And that clearly is not the case for the last 40 years.
And is this data compiled by NOAA, who we earlier referred to, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration?
Yeah, NOAA compiles this from measurements worldwide from all major countries are taking these measurements and buoys out in the oceans and things like that. And so this is a compilation of all those measurement sources.
Now, how much has the planted heated on average already?
We've heated about 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.2 degrees centigrade in this last 120 years.
And we have a graph up here. Global warming of the last 120 years is 2.2 Fahrenheit. Can you briefly explain this graph if necessary, referring to the prior NOAA data?
Yeah, this is effectively just a similar look at that same data from before, but showing a little more detail of the fact that we are on a continuous upward trajectory now for the last 40 years.
Now, similar to one part per million, 1.2 C or 2.2 F, those don't sound like temperatures that should affect anything, are they?
We've experienced a couple degree temperature change in the last hour. And so looking at an average like that in an instantaneous way is not climate science. What we're looking at is that accumulation of that increment of temperature through the whole year. And so it does seem a little odd to most people that those don't sound like very big numbers, because we experience 10 and 20 degrees and 30 degrees of variation every day. And so you have to pay attention to the fact that these are an increment that occurs every day over the average and worldwide.
So have there been changes in what I'm going to call the boundaries of temperature, hot days and cold days?
Yeah, it's NOAA, after a number of false tries at how to represent this data, has realized the best way to look at these, instead of just picking an individual event, is to look at what percentage of the weather stations around the country are higher than average for the day, and particularly that have broken their records for that date. And so they keep track now of the thousands of stations around the country, how many of them on a given day broke their all-time record high for the day or low for the day. And so then you're not focusing on any one event in any one place. You're looking at the cumulative measure of extreme hot versus cold temperatures. And you can just see at a glance from the colors there that in the last 30 years, we're massively more extreme hot days, records broken than cold days.
So the blue is cold, and if you could just explain a couple of these numbers. So let's take the first year, the 1950s, you get 12.4% on this graph, and in terms of cold, 7.5%. What's that mean?
What they've done with this depiction is they, for the stations that were breaking their temperature records, either hot or cold, they would calculate the area, not just a station count. And so in this case, in the 1950s, 12% of the land area of the country was unusually hot, and 7% was unusually cold. And then you can just work decade by decade and see those fractions.
So as we look at the data for the last decade, 3.8% of the days are unusual cold, but 22% of the days are unusually hot. Is that what that depicts?
Right. And look at the decade before that. There was almost no measured days record lows.
And so it's in terms of climate, is this the way you try to look, you look at trends as opposed to a particular year or a couple of years?
Yes, to do climate and particularly global climate work, you can't look at any one place and you can't look at just any one instance. You're looking at worldwide conditions over decades of period, usually at least 50 years and more, even 70 or 80 years if data sets are available. And so just looking at any single one event really doesn't give us much of a climate sense, climate trend at all.
But if we do look at one event, what happened in June 28, 2021, what does that show you?
Yeah, this, since we all here in Montana were just at the edge of this, it didn't quite get over to us, but this was that famous heat wave of 2 years ago. I've lived in Seattle and Portland. I don't know what to think of Portland being 116 degrees. I think it broke its all-time record high by something like 8 or 10 degrees that day, June 28th. You recognize that's hotter than Dallas, Texas, and it occurred in Portland. I'd have to say amongst the climate scientists, they're still puzzled of how this happened. This broke all the molds of everything they thought they understood about climate extremes. And it's kind of an example of the sort of thing that may happen in the future in completely unpredictable ways. This developed and generated these unbelievable temperatures just in a matter of a week.
In your opinion, is there any uncertainty that if fossil fuel emissions continue, the Earth will heat more?
The Earth will keep trapping this additional heat, and then periodically we will end up with surprises like this that will break out in ways we can't predict ahead of time.
So do small amounts of fossil fuel pollution matter?
Well, every amount of emission matters.
And does every amount expose the plaintiffs to more serious risks?
Yes.
Now, let's spend a moment explaining the concept of climate feedbacks. We have a diagram here. How do climate feedbacks drive more warming?
Yeah, this logic is particularly useful for us in Montana because we have a seasonal snowpack. And areas that don't have seasonal snow don't understand this nearly as well as we all do, because we experience it every year. And of course, as you go farther north, even more the case that as temperatures are increasing, you have earlier snow melt and sea ice melt. Well, ice and snow is the brightest natural surface there is. It reflects more of solar radiation than any other natural surface. It's like a mirror. The sunlight comes down and is reflected right back into space. Well, when you have a nice bright snow surface and then that snow melts, that surface goes from about 60% reflectiveness to about 10%. And so all of a sudden, 50% of additional energy is being trapped that a week before when it was snow covered, it wasn't. That's where we see the amplification of high latitudes, particularly as this points Arctic sea ice. The sea ice, if you've ever flown over high latitudes and looked out the window, I always try to get a window seat. You look down at the snow and the ice and it's bright white. You fly over water and it looks almost pitch black. And so once you have open water, like in the Arctic Ocean, then you're going to suddenly massively increase the absorption of that energy into the system. And that then, as the diagram shows, warms the high latitudes, things like that. We're getting permafrost melt in places we've never had permafrost melting, and that releases more CO2 and methane, and the feedback just comes right around and accelerates the whole dynamic.
And that's primarily driven by human activities releasing CO2.
That's the initial trigger, yeah.
Burning fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Running, since the 1990s, there have been a lot of government climate science reports, as you've testified to. What has been the trend of these reports in warning the world about the climate crisis?
I think as each report comes out, not only are they following the standard temperature metrics and things like the Keeling curve as it marches along, but we're also identifying more and more of these more intricate feedback loops that 20 or 30 years ago we just didn't have data about. And so we're learning more and more of these kind of feedbacks are developing, and we kind of cringe on what we might discover next, to tell you the truth.
Your Honor, I'm going to be referring to Exhibit P143, the synthesis report of the IPCC Sixth Assessment Report Summary for Policymakers, and I'd like to move that into evidence.
Objection, hearsay. I'd like to note for the record that whether Dr. Running relied on it does not change it from being hearsay.
Excuse me, Your Honor. The Dr. Running's testified that the IPCC report was prepared by the government and relies on government data, so it's a public record as an exception to hearsay.
May I respond to that, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't think it's our government. I don't think it falls within that exception. So, objection also lacked foundation.
Well, I'm going to admit P143.
So, Dr. Running, on March 20, 2023, the summary for policymakers for the Sixth Assessment Report was issued. You're familiar with this report.
Yes.
And is it authoritative on the state of climate change?
Yes, it's our most recent summary. This is only a few months old.
Okay. And in the Sixth Assessment Report, what conclusions does it reach about increases in greenhouse gas concentrations?
Number one, that they're occurring and they're being quantified by the Keeling curve and equivalent world around the world. And second, they're absolutely caused by human activity and vast predominance of burning fossil fuels.
And what is it state about historical accumulations of CO2 within the past, say, 30 years?
It's accelerated to the point where a full 42% of the total accumulation of CO2 emissions has all happened in the last 30 years.
I'm going to read a portion of the report, and then I'm going to ask you if you agree with and can comment on the statement I'm reading. And the statement is as follows. It's under the heading Future Climate Change, and it reads, continued emissions will further affect all major climate system components, with every additional increment of global warming. Changes in extremes continue to become larger. Continued global warming is projected to further intensify the global water cycle, including its variability, global monsoon precipitation, and very wet and very dry weather and climate events and seasons, high confidence. Dr. Running, can you explain to me, first of all, this italicized high confidence? What's that mean in IPCC reports?
Yes, in the very beginning, after the first IPCC report, they realized that different authors were using statements of confidence in somewhat different ways. And they realized that it was extremely critical that we be absolutely consistent. And so as authors, we got our marching orders on our first authors meeting of this details of quantifying the uncertainty with factual statements from low, medium to high and very high confidence. And they pay, and I'm sure still pay, very strict attention to that being used accurately, because they realize that it's important for everyone to know the level of confidence we have in a given factual statement.
And you've been reading these IPCC reports since the beginning. Has the language a concern in your view? The IPCC authors, are they getting more concerned over the years?
When I go back and read our text from the fourth assessment in 2007, and then I read a text from this assessment, the very first time I read this, it just struck me how much more tone of absolute alarm. I think hard to use this word, but even panic in the author's words. And these are scientists that are pretty cold, sober, unemotional sorts of characters. And for them to be using these kind of words repeatedly in their text, just really, I noticed the minute I read it compared to ours from 15 years ago. These are just getting more strident in the statements that they're trying to make, literally trying to get humanity to pay attention.
And one term I'd like to add, we're going to talk a bit about more later, is what's called the global water cycle. Briefly, what's that?
That's the cycling of water from the oceans, evaporating up into the atmosphere, and clouds coming over and raining on us, and then the water streaming back in rivers back to the ocean. And that's that simple summary of the hydrologic cycle.
Another statement in the IPCC report I'm going to read is cryosphere-related changes in floods, landslides, and water availability have the potential to lead to severe consequences for people, infrastructure, and the economy in most mountain regions. High confidence. The projected increase in frequency and intensity of heavy precipitation, high confidence, will increase rain-generated local flooding, medium confidence. Generally, Dr. Running, can you explain what those statements mean?
First, recognize cryosphere simply means snow and ice. We're familiar with here in Montana. This particular text is trying to point out that because of the warming Earth, we have much more probability of really damaging effects in our mountains. It starts with when we start having rain on snow in the middle of the winter. And I think we all recognize that's becoming a common occurrence. That can often trigger then a substantial flooding downstream. And I guess a perfect example is Yellowstone a year ago. That's exactly what happened, that blew out the road going into Yellowstone Park. That was all in the news, was a big rain event on top of snow. So you have both the rainwater and the melted snow all coming down at once.
The next statement I'd like you to explain from the IPCC sixth assessment report reads as follows. With further warming, every region is projected to increasingly experience concurrent and multiple changes in climatic impact drivers. Compound heat waves and droughts are projected to become more frequent, including concurrent events across multiple locations. High confidence. Can you translate that to layman's terms?
You know, as you read this, I think I don't know how anybody could read more than about 10 pages of an IPCC report without going and taking a nap. we are absolutely forced into writing at this level of density. This is not the language you would use to explain something to the public at all. But they have so many factual statements to get into so few paragraphs that you end up with a paragraph like this that when you parse through it is absolutely real. It's absolutely correct. You see they have high confidence in it, but it does make for a tough read, even for me, and I make a living doing this stuff.
So when it talks about every region, does that include Montana?
Certainly does.
And so essentially, compound heat waves and droughts are going to be more frequent. Is that one of the bottom lines from this statement?
Yeah, that's probably what's expected.
Also in the IPCC sixth assessment report, it reads, in the near term, every region in the world is projected to face further increases in climate hazards. Medium to high confidence, depending on region and hazard, increasing multiple risks to ecosystems and humans, very high confidence, hazards and associated risks expected in the near term include, and I'm going to go on, an increase in heat-related human mortality and morbidity, high confidence, foodborne, waterborne, and vector-borne diseases, high confidence, and mental health challenges, very high confidence. Flooding in coastal and other low-lying cities and regions, high confidence, biodiversity loss in land, freshwater and ocean ecosystems, medium to very high confidence depending on ecosystem, and a decrease in food production in some regions, high confidence. Dr. Running, here we experienced the term twice.
You're all right. I want to object to the narrative testimony by counsel. It's beyond leading the witness.
Well, he's reading from the report, but try to get to a question there, please.
Yes. What does very high confidence mean in terms of these statements?
Well, as I iterated a few minutes ago, and we were given very clear definitions of levels of confidence of any factual statement from low to medium to high and then to finally very high confidence. And very high confidence is exactly what it means. You kind of find no scientist will ever say something is 100% confident. They just somehow refuse to do it. It's always something could happen, but this is about as close to certainty as a scientist is willing to state.
And briefly, can you explain what's meant by, it talks about these, the terms, I'm sorry, it's on the prior slide. Every region in the world is projected to face further increases in climate hazards. What's meant by climate hazards?
Climate hazards are weather events that specifically do harm to human populations and human infrastructure.
Now, based on the findings I've just read into the record, what do they illustrate if you combine them together?
What they illustrate and what we document from a variety of sources is year by year and decade by decade, we're getting more and more and more of these extreme events. And these include everything from hurricanes to our wildfires, stronger tornadoes. These kind of extreme events are just becoming more more a case. And then drought, which doesn't seem immediately extreme, but in our end of the world, drought is a slow motion crisis. that as the system gets drier and drier and the months keep ticking by, there's more and more damage to that system from lack of water.
The last part I'd like to read from the report is, quote, climate change is a threat to human well-being and planetary health. Very high confidence. There is a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. Very high confidence. The choices and actions implemented in this decade will have impacts now and for thousands of years. High confidence. Do you agree with that statement, Dr. Running?
Yes, and it's remarkable to me how they're willing to put in print very high confidence over and over and over.
And by a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. Does that apply to these 16 Montana plaintiffs?
It certainly does.
Let's turn now to water in the Western United States ecosystem. And we have a graph here on declining snowpack. Can you explain what this graph shows, chart?
Yes, probably many of us are familiar that the government designated a long time ago to measure the snow depth and water equivalent on April 1st every year, all across the western U.S. And that was, at the time, meant to be the peak of the winter snowpack just before the melt started in the spring. Well, nowadays, the melt starts way before April 1st. And what this graphic shows is from 1955 to 2016, across the entire western United States, by the numbers that you can see, the largest circles are 80%, the smallest 20%, but every single red circle is a snow measurement site where the trend over this time period has declined of April 1st snow water equivalent. And the consistency across the entire West is quite striking.
So I see a number of large red circles in the area depicting Montana. What does that mean?
That means that their April 1 soil water equivalent is between 60 and 80% lower and now on average than it was in the 1950s.
And I forgot to ask you, what's snow water equivalent?
Well, we all know about champagne powder, and that's when we all call in sick. It's kind of conspicuous in our ski areas how many people get sick when there's fresh powder. Really good fresh powder will be about 10 to even 15 inches of powder per 1 inch of water. Okay, and so the snow water equivalent is the 1 inch of water. And because snow itself is so variable in water content, and the hydrologists are most interested in the water part, not the snow part, they standardize this measurement to SWE, as they like to call it.
So if it's rain or if it's snow, in other words, the amount of precipitation doesn't change much over the year, why does whether it's rain or snow matter?
What matters is that snowpack is the perfect storage medium for wintertime precipitation. Our Montana ecosystems would look dramatically different if we didn't have a winter snowpack, because just as a generality, we get about 1 inch of precipitation a month all year round. I'm quoting Missoula numbers now because I know them the best. Well, what that really means is through the winter, we accumulate those 1 inch per month up in snowpack, and then that melts nicely in the spring for the summer growing season. If that same water would have gone to the rivers and basically flown out to the, flowed out to the ocean in January, it wouldn't have helped those ecosystems at all. And so snowpack is a really big deal for us because it's our winter storage reservoir.
Have you ever done research on this issue?
Oh, yeah.
And did the research talk to you at all about what's happening with the streams and rivers and in terms of?
Yeah, what we see to put this in the full seasonal perspective is that on average now our snowpack start, our snow melt in the spring starts about 2 weeks earlier. And what that then means is our summer dry season starts 2 weeks earlier. And what that then means is by August, our stream flow is getting low enough that fish and game has to close off fishing sometimes because the streams are too low and too hot. And that's something that didn't used to happen.
So the testimony is going to be plaintiffs, Kean, Lander, Badge, they all fly fish. Is their fly fishing season in jeopardy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Already is.
And one thing you talked about is whether a warming climate is causing some effects perhaps differently in one place than another. We have a slide up here. Can you explain this?
Yes. A lot of climate scientists in trying to just make a simple direct statement, particularly of the hydrologic part of global warming, will make this statement, well, the wet regions are going to get wetter and the dry regions are going to get drier. And at first glance, if you're not a scientist, it seems kind of contradictory. How can both of those things be true? I started out by trying to explain to my public audiences the saturation vapor pressure curve. That didn't go so well. And so even though all of you should know about it, this is, I hope, a more easily understood way to think our way through this. And it basically means, since we've already established that atmosphere is getting warmer, what we know is warmer air can hold more water vapor. That's what the saturation vapor pressure is. Warmer air holds more water. All of us that have had a vacation to the tropics, they open the airplane door and it just hits you like a ton of bricks. And it's because there's five times as much water vapor in that hot air as we're accustomed to in Montana. So if as the atmosphere is warming up, if there's water around, like out in the ocean or the Amazon, the picture here, then it evaporates more water into the clouds, and those clouds go over and then rain harder. So that's the wet gets wetter part. But how about if the atmosphere is over some dry desert? It got warmer, but there's no water to evaporate into the atmosphere. And so the atmosphere simply is hotter and drier and the humidity is lower. And so that's how dry seasons, dry areas get drier. So you can see once you think your way through this, absolutely both of these things can be happening at the same time in various places on Earth.
Before we shift into a different area, I wanted you to describe for us the concept known as plant water stress.
That's actually what I did my thesis work on. So I won't take you down to the gory details. It simply means that a plant has an optimal level of hydration, just like we do. And when you think about it, I think easier to think in our human body. We have an optimum level of hydration. And if we go out and overexert and don't drink water, we end up dehydrated. We call it dehydrated. Well, plants in much the same way end up dehydrated so they can't function as effectively. And if that goes on for too long, then they die.
Has there been an increase in drought and plant water stress?
When you look on the global level, there's been an increase in MAP drought and plant water stress.
And what about in the Western United States, including Montana? Has that occurred there?
Yes, we've we've been in a number of these drought cycles over the last, the West, they think, is the longest, strongest drought in 500 years.
Has there also been an increase in what I'm going to call forest mortality?
Yes, and that's a manifestation of a tree that was stressed for too long until it died. And so we've certainly had that here and there in Montana for us. And one of the most immediate problems with that is then insect epidemics can get the upper hand on these stressed, weakened trees. And so the mountain pine beetle epidemic that we're just coming to the end of now, that went for a good decade and killed millions of acres of pine forest.
I'd like now to turn to wildfire season. Briefly, can you describe the role of climate change on wildfire season and wildfires?
Yeah, it's really just an extension of what the discussion we're already having about hot air getting drier when there's not evaporating water from the surface. What we now have clearly documented is we've already talked about the snowpack melting earlier, and so the higher mountains are drying in ways that they didn't used to. The length of the ignition season, let's call it the season where it's dry enough for the system to ignite, say with a lightning strike, is getting longer. And this is now, there's just lots of papers documenting this.
So wildfires are burning more severely?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And how does, or how do drier forests lead to more fires?
Well, simply as the forest gets to a point of dryness, I experience this all the time when I'm trying to make a campfire. Once the system gets so dry, you don't even need any kindling. One match and a couple of pine needles and off it goes. Whereas if it's a little bit wetter, you still have to struggle to get that fire going. So that's a real world hands-on example of exactly what we're talking about. The acceleration of wildfires because the system is so much drier than it was 30, 40 years ago.
Has climate change increased the number of acres of forest burned per year?
Overall, there is a fair bit of variability from one year to the next. But when you look, I think the clearest statistic is this one, that the 10 largest fire seasons in U.S. history have all occurred in the last less than 20 years.
And where did you get the data for this one?
Usually the best summary statistics come from NIFCE, the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise.
And what's that?
That's the National Interagency Fire Center. It's, I'm going to get thrown out of here soon. It's a cross-agency coordination where across not only all the federal agencies, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the Geological Service, the Park Service, federal land ownership, and then the state land ownership, they try to all get together and put all these statistics together so we have a full national look at our fire dynamics. And that's what NIFCE's job is.
You just testified about acres burned per year increasing. Is the fire season getting longer?
Yeah, this is a good look from 1980 when the fire season was 90 days long, so about 3 months long. It's now 150 days long, so it's a full 2 months longer than it was. The bottom of the y-axis is January 1st, and that the top is Christmas time. So you're looking at seasonality going vertically, which is a little weird for a graph, but it works. And so you're seeing with that bottom black line, you're seeing the change in the springtime initial beginning of the fire season. And that's exactly that early season snowmelt that I've been talking about. This shows that as the snow melts earlier and earlier, then the fire season can start as that system dries out. And yet there's not so much change in the fall. Yet most of this change you can see straight from these statistics is earlier start up in the spring.
Well, will wildfires only occur in this, what we'll call 150-day range?
Well, it's really been amazing. What's most obvious for us here, remember the fire in Denton, Montana, only about a year ago. That started on December 1st. We now have grass fires, wildfires in the eastern Montana, in Billings in the dead of winter. The big fire in Colorado that burned 400 houses in Boulder happened in December. And so a lot of fire scientists say in many areas we're virtually at a point of year-round fire vulnerability.
And what's causing the longer fire season?
The warming temperatures.
And does it make sense that these youth plaintiffs have been experiencing more wildfire smoke for more months of the year than adults experienced when they were younger, say 20 years ago?
Objection, lack of foundation and speculation.
Well, have him expound.
Okay. Well, can you explain, based on your experience in Montana, about why it would make sense that these young plaintiffs are experiencing more wildfire smoke?
Well, I would simply point to the news last week of New York City, where they found out what this is all about. And here we are in the early part of June, and they're enduring wildfires from all the way across the continent, across Canada. So to me, this right out of the recent headlines is Exhibit A of what we're referring to.
And you earlier alluded to forest pathogens and insects. What effect is climate change having on that?
Well, the longer, drier summer, it all fits, you know, this story all fits together quite logically. You start with an earlier snowmelt. These trees happen to endure a longer, drier summer where they come under plant water stress. When they're stressed, they can't defend against insect attacks. And the reason trees produce pitch and terpenes and things like that is to repel insects. And this is their defense mechanism. And when they're stressed, they can't generate pitch. And so then the insects can pile on and overwhelm that tree and kill it and then move on to the next tree. And this just is illustration of, as you see, 14 Montana forests that showed insect mortality from 2000 to 2015.
Now, what mechanisms influence forest pathogens and influence as a result of climate change?
Well, the biggest thing is stress of the host trees, but there is an additional on the insect side of the story. They can live through the wintertime more successfully than the past. It used to be when we would have minus 20 and minus 30 degree temperatures periodically in the winter. That was enough to kill those overwintering insects. And now when so many of our winters only barely get below zero, they overwintered more successfully. So there's a bigger population ready to go first thing in the spring.
So one last slide on this, insects and fire in Northwest forests. Can you explain this slide that we're now displaying?
Yeah, the left-hand image shows measured areas of fire in the northwest, perimeters of fires, and then perimeters of insect and disease area. The right-hand side is a projection with the global climate models of where the future probability of increases in area of both fire burning and then insect epidemics. This is a slide I used in the National Climate Assessment in 2014.
So this slide, in essence, predicts, attempts to predict what's going to happen in the future, both as a result of insects and fires. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And what's the reason for these numbers?
Well, it's back to the same thing. We're warming the entire planet, and we're having shorter winter seasons and longer summer seasons. And this is the net result.
I'd like to shift now to wildlife. What's the impact of climate change on wildlife?
It's quite variable depending on the animal, depending on where they live. And so we don't have as, and it just hasn't been studied for nearly as long. We have a couple of examples that are fairly well understood now. A good example, the pika and the marmots that live in our alpine meadows, in Glacier National Park, those animals both require a snowpack for their successful life cycle. And so as our snowpack is declining, then this is making their successful life cycle and breeding and rearing of their young more and more difficult.
You spoke about the pika. What about
probably the classic?
I need to object, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't know that Dr. Running is qualified as a wildlife biologist.
I was a co-author on this paper.
I would draw my attention.
Thank you.
Can you explain the picture of the snowshoe hares?
Yeah, this work was featured on the cover of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which every scientist I know dreams about getting the cover of PNAS once in their lifetime. And this group did it. And basically, the pictures tell the whole story. There's certain animals that are genetically timed to change their coat color so that in the wintertime they turn white to blend in with the snow, the lower left. In the summertime, that white coat turns brown so they fit in with the vegetation. Well, because that's genetically timed, it can't change through the life of that animal. So you look on that upper left, that little bunny has turned white, but it hasn't snowed yet from exactly the climate change we're talking about. It hadn't snowed, and there you see how that sticks out to any predator around. And then on the other end of the winter, that bunny is still white. And yeah, the snow's melted early. And so here in the spring, it's also mismatched to the background. And this is just a classic illustration of a wildlife life cycle that is already being substantially disrupted by climate change.
So with all that you've testified to, Dr. Running, why do the greenhouse gas emissions caused by Montana matter so much to the climate system to justify considering them?
Well, because we don't know what we're going to find next of these kind of problems. The disconnect between the current climate that's changing through the decades and our ecosystems that live within that climate, these kind of disconnects we're finding more of, and we wonder what we'll find next.
So do fossil fuel emissions burned in particular locales matter?
Well, it matters every locale.
And do they go up into the atmosphere?
Yeah, wherever these fossil fuels are burned, they mix through the atmosphere quite quickly. I've actually found it a good illustration that people can relate to. If you were around when Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, and of course in Missoula, the ash cloud went right over us. I had about a centimeter in my yard. Well, 14 days later, the ash cloud was back. And that showed it, the atmosphere had gone around the entire planet and come back overhead. And it's an illustration to us in this context that it doesn't matter where that CO2 is emitted. It will mix through the entire planetary atmosphere within a matter of weeks.
And perhaps have an effect in Montana.
Montana and everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. So would failure to consider the climate change impacts, in your mind, be reasonable?
No, I think we're already seeing levels of damage and vulnerability that I think certainly the IPCC scientists are already getting exceptionally nervous. And the thought of continuing this trajectory is to even more vulnerability and damage. It's hard for me to imagine why anybody chooses to do that.
Given the interrelatedness you've just testified about, would failure to consider the climate change impacts be reasonable from a scientific perspective?
No, not at all. But
Dr. Running, is the fossil fuel pollution emitted by and as a result of the accident in Montana from 1960s to 2011 still affecting the stability of the climate system today?
CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a few centuries once it's emitted, and so emissions from 50 years ago are in large measure still up there.
So
this accumulation just continues.
So is our CO2 fossil fuel emissions from, let's say, 2011 to 2023, are they affecting the stability of the climate system?
That imbalance is becoming greater and greater. That energy imbalance that we saw earlier is just getting more extreme.
And so if the state of Montana continues to extract, transport, and consume fossil fuels, what will happen to the climate system?
Well, there's parts that we know what will happen, and that certainly is it'll keep getting warmer, and the hydrologic cycle will keep getting more extreme in both directions, as I pointed out. And the tougher part is where we don't know after that. We're, as one of the most famous earth scientists said, we are embarking on a grand geophysical experiment, the end point of which is unknown.
But based on the evidence you've seen, does it point to harm for these new plaintiffs?
Harm now and accelerating harm in the future.
Recently, the state of Montana repealed the Energy Policy Act. Does the repeal of the statute, the Energy Policy Act, have any effect on your opinions that you've given today?
Objection. Calls for legal conclusion.
Well, it does, but overruled as far as – I think he's already testified to the fact that the impacts remain. But.
Does the repeal of the statute affect your opinions?
No, it's pretty hard to repeal physics.
So, Dr. Running, if let's go over some of the opinions you've made in this case to kind of sum up your conclusions. In the IPCC report, it states continued emissions will further affect all major climate system components, and many changes will be irreversible on centennial to millennial timescales and become larger with increasing global warming. Without urgent, effective, and equitable mitigation and adaptation actions, climate change increasingly threatens ecosystems, biodiversity, and the livelihoods, health, and well-being of current and future generations. High confidence. Do you agree with this in this statement?
Objection, cumulative, and leading.
Overruled. Go ahead.
I agree with the statement, and I also want to make the point that IPCC writing is heavily reviewed, and even a single sentence that can't be justified by hard science is edited out. And so for them to write these sentences and withstand the review that IPCC texts undergo is a pretty remarkable statement.
So is what's the time frame that's available to us to avoid locking in irrevocable climate impacts?
We really have to change the trajectory of emissions. And we should have done it decades ago, but the next best thing is right now. We have to slow down the trajectory of emissions, and that then encourages the rest of our economy to come and find develop other energy sources, and then keep driving emissions down to a point where we can reach that climate stability.
And Dr. Running, how, in your opinion, would we restore a stable climate?
Objection asked and answered. Repetitive.
Sustained.
Well, Dr. Running, what, in your view, is the standard to restore a stable climate?
Well, I think as some of those earlier text shows, our best estimate is about an atmospheric CO2 of 350 parts per million. Now, what's interesting is that's the point we were at in 1988. That isn't all that long ago. We were at 350. So this is, in my mind, well within humanity's capability to simply return to 1988 atmospheric CO2.
And do you, in your opinion, do you need to have a stable climate to have a clean and healthful environment from a scientific perspective?
Yes, I think so.
And if you don't, will that harm these plaintiffs?
Objection asked and answered, cumulative.
Sustained.
Now, the plaintiffs are going to live to the end of the century. Why can't they wait till then to take steps to achieve a clean and healthful environment?
At the rate of acceleration we're currently in now, it's hard to imagine where at the end of the century we'll be. In terms of energy imbalance, the climate instability, in terms of the extreme events that we're already starting to see around the world, and in terms of the sea level rise, which we expect to be at least a meter of sea level rise, and I could go on and a number of other examples, and 80 more years of this trajectory, it's hard to imagine where the Earth system would be functionally.
Thank you, Dr. Running. I have no further questions.
You want to start? We can have 15 minutes to start. All right. Ross?
Good afternoon, Dr. Running.
Wow.
Mark Smith again. We've met before.
Right.
Just picking up on the very last part of your testimony, And throughout your testimony, you talk about what we need to do to address these issues. Who is the we that you're referring to?
We is ultimately humanity as a whole.
And you're aware, I assume, that with all due respect to the court, this is not a court for humanity. This is a court for the state of Montana, right?
Correct.
So that's the context that we have to deal with here. Okay. You understand that? And I ask that not to be facetious, but you also were clear in testifying that the entire paradigm that we've been talking about is a global issue, correct?
Right.
And as you put it, or the words to these effect, a ton of carbon dioxide in Montana is the same as a ton in the other side of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was a yes.
Yes, sorry.
So, and it's correct that the other side of the coin is true. Tell me if I'm wrong, that not removing a ton of carbon dioxide here is the same as not removing it in Pakistan or wherever else. Correct?
Certainly, at a global scale.
So, and just to try to make things a little more efficient here, in everything that you talk about, the effects that you've seen from climate change, those effects they may be, first of all, felt differently in some places other than others, correct?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And so we want to be careful not to generalize about that.
Yeah, we don't worry too much about sea level rise here, for example.
Right, right.
But other places sure do.
Okay. So, for example, you know, what the state of Montana's contribution to all of this is that a relevant question for you?
Not particularly, because I think everyone has their own responsibility for their part in solving this problem. And Montana citizens have their responsibility just like everyone else.
But I think if I heard you correctly, you testified about harm to the plaintiffs in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it this way. Whatever, it's correct to say, whatever harm you believe they are suffering from climate change, 16 youths in Pakistan, you know, could theoretically be suffering the same thing. Is that a fair statement?
The same type for their regional climate, the same types of issues, sure. In fact, they're getting incredible heat waves there.
And I just picked Pakistan. I don't know.
No.
Here in a case, I think you understand this, that is about the power of the state government to deal with this through the statute that is relevant, which is the Montana Environmental Policy Act.
Yeah.
You're aware of that?
I'm aware of that. I'm not a policy. But I try to keep up like a citizen at least.
Sure. And let me see if you're comfortable with this statement. And if we look at all of your testimony today, it's all centered on the global causes of climate change, the global effects of climate change, and the steps that you've testified to that you believe we need to take to become
correct
more yeah. stable at least.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So when we talk about, for example, the 350 parts per million standard, for lack of a better level, for lack of a better description, to get there, the state of Montana can't do that on its own, right?
No.
If the court were to order today assuming hypothetically, this is hypothetical, the court had the power to ban the emission of any greenhouse gases in Montana, to ban the transportation of any fossil fuels in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
If that occurred, what would the impact be on global climate change?
Proper hypothetical, Your Honor. This counsel just admitted the court doesn't have the authority to do that.
Can you kind of rephrase, Mr. Stearns?
Well, there was much testimony. We've listened for an hour and a half to testimony about getting back to levels of previous right. decades. And you were asked directly what it would take to get to the point where we're out of the woods, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And you said, what do? We stop using fossil fuels mm-hmm. or something to that effect.
Yeah.
So if the judge ordered that we stop using fossil fuels in Montana, would that get us to the point where these plaintiffs are no longer being harmed, in your opinion?
We can't tell in advance because what has been shown in history over and over and over again is when a significant social movement is needed, it often is started by one or two or three people. And so if our state decided to do this, do what you're hypothesizing, we can't tell how many other states would decide that's the right thing to do, and we're going to do it too.
Is that your scientific?
And then extrapolate that to countries all around the world. U.S. likes to claim that we're a leader, and this is the kind of issue that maybe we should show some leadership.
Is that a scientific opinion or a personal opinion?
That probably gets to be half of each.
And the same is true for all of the IPCC language that we saw on the pages of the reports and so forth. That's not focused on Montana in particular. That's a global
right.
report. Is that right? Do you, can you tell us in a shorthand way what other sources of CO2 there are out there that are non-anthropogenic?
The natural ecosystems produce CO2 in decomposition of dead matter. Every one of us is producing CO2 right now. Every living organism respires CO2 continuously in their metabolic processes. And so there's no doubt that the CO2 cycle as a whole, when we had to figure it out, we first had to figure out what the whole natural cycle was and then add on top of that where this additional CO2 was coming in and where it goes to in the system. Because you're right, we started with a huge natural CO2 cycle to begin with that was not fully understood 50 years ago.
In the chart we saw or the graph that showed the 81% or 88% of anthropogenic CO2 versus the land use CO2.
Oh, yeah, 89%.
89 versus 11.
Yeah, versus 11%.
Is the natural CO2 accounted for in that 11%, or how do we figure that in?
No, you recognize that graphic was for anthropogenic CO2 emissions. And so that was not at all quantifying the natural CO2 cycle.
And does that cycle change, the natural cycle, over time? And if so, what causes that? Is that a question that makes sense to you? Judging by the look on your face, it may not.
I wrote a paper in Science Magazine in 2012 recommending terrestrial net primary production as what they call a planetary boundary. And I argued in that paper that it appears that the fundamental constraints of the natural biospheric cycle seem really pretty stable. We know the solar constant is constant. We measure it all the time. And it turns out that the other constraints on plant production also seem at a global scale to be really quite conservative. There's certainly good years in one country and bad years in it. At the same time, there's bad years. But when we put it all together globally, it seems quite stable. So it's an interesting intellectual challenge to argue that it could be that biospheric CO2 cycle is actually pretty stable.
Again, thinking about that same chart with the 89%, does that 89% represent emissions only? In other words, greenhouse gases that are combusted?
Right. Yeah, those are statistics gathered from all the countries of their oil, coal, and gas consumption and emissions, since those are commodity products. They have good economic data of how much is being used every year, and those are compiled for that graph.
In your work in estimating or calculating greenhouse gas emissions and CO2 impacts, is it standard to include besides greenhouse gases that are emitted or that are combusted and emitted, fossil fuels that are transported? In other words, you count them if they're on a train just by virtue of being transported. Coal is a good example.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation that they, and it's particularly this Global Carbon Project, has spent a lot of time trying to work through is in effect the bean counting, you might say, of which country should the emission be assigned to when you send energy to another country to build products that they then sell back to you. Is it the emission for their country, or it is an emission for the country that bought the product? And you can get into a lot of tedious detail, as you can imagine. And I find that we're usually better off just standing back from that detail and saying, let's look back to the entire final global bottom line. If it's emitted anywhere and goes into the atmosphere, it goes everywhere. And that, I think, is what's most important for our consideration here. And drilling down into those details of country by country gets to be quite a mess real quick. And you can argue on either side.
But the effect is the scientific effect, the impact is caused by the emission.
Is the final combustion, yeah.
Combustion.
Yeah.
When we talk about I'm trying to think of what the term was, that where the ocean's reflection changes by virtue of ice melting.
Oh, the surface albedo is what the scientists would call it. Really, the reflectivity of the surface is a word we most of us recognize better.
So the same thing is true for that sort of impact, is that it's the result of what goes on globally, regardless of where we look.
Yes, the statistics we're showing here are final cumulative statistics for energy budgets of all around the world. And so open ocean, the Arctic sea ice, Antarctica, the Amazon, everywhere. Our satellites like my satellites I work with, have global coverage every day. So we get a daily look at the whole planet from the point of view of that reflectivity of those different surfaces.
And just another question about Montana's role in all of this. Have you calculated Montana's contribution to total greenhouse gas or CO2 loading?
No, I haven't. I think other witnesses, we might have that information, but I tend to do most of my work globally.
So that applies to your entire testimony here today. It's not intended to tell us what Montana's specific role in this is, other than as a member of the world and as humans.
Well, we have expert witnesses that are coming later that, like Dr. Whitlock, that'll zoom in more specifically to Montana. So I'm only the lead here.
Dr. Running, just real quickly, a couple of questions. We talked about briefly a minute ago about the, sources of CO2, anthropogenic and non-anthropogenic.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any difference between those two in the way the biosphere reacts to them?
There's a difference in the carbon isotope ratio of fossil fuels and biospheric CO2, which is why we can really identify quite accurately the fraction that's fossil fuel and origin. In terms of function in the biosphere, there's only a little bit of discrimination of the different isotopes of carbon, a little bit, but within our context, that's not our issue.
You mentioned that we were able to go to 350 parts per million, that we would at least start to balance things out. And then you also said, I believe, that there's a certain amount of unpredictability about what else might happen, mm-hmm. correct? What is, given the strident language that you focused on in the IPCC report, what is the source of that unpredictability?
A couple of physical issues. For example, a good one that I think we can easily picture is we talked about how sea ice reflects most of the energy, and once it's melted out, the water soaks in more. Okay, so imagine when the Arctic Ocean becomes completely ice-free in the summertime. And that means all that ocean water is going to be absorbing more energy, and somehow or other the circulation of the Arctic Ocean is going to change. And we don't know how it's going to change because we've never seen it ice-free before. So it's just a great example of after the melt-out, we have educated guesses, but we can't really tell what that might manifest itself in, for example, ocean circulation, particularly in the Atlantic Ocean, and once the Arctic is ice-free. And you multiply that same concept by a lot of other things. That was just an example I thought would be pretty easily, easy for all of us to think about.
Again, in view of the language of the IPCC report, there's a certain element of unpredictability if we don't do anything as well, correct? Mm-hmm. Is that you got to answer for
me? Say again.
I said, yeah, sure. There's a certain element of unpredictability even if we don't do anything.
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah, if we do nothing but continue as we call business as usual, the climate models try to project forward that, and they suggest these accelerating disturbance rates, accelerating sea level rise, accelerating glacial retreat. But in reality, other things like that Pacific Northwest heat wave, they just were dumbfounded. How could this happen that Portland hit 116? And I think there's probably a couple of PhD dissertations underway right now trying to figure it out.
That's all I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Redirect.
Thank you, Your Honor. Will every ton of CO2 that Montana's government allows to be emitted contribute to a more destabilized climate?
Certainly.
And will every ton of CO2 Montana's government allows to be emitted make it harder to restore a stable climate?
Yeah, likewise. We're going the wrong way in this issue with every ton of CO2 emitted.
And can Montana take steps to help get towards the 350 parts per million standard?
I'm not a policy expert, but I recognize that the state of Montana, through permitting on state lands particularly, has authority for coal and gas and oil development.
You were asked about the IPCC report being global, but some of the quotes we discussed confirmed impact in every region. Right?
Yes, correct.
And that would include Montana, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And is there any reason to think that Montana is not experiencing the kind of impacts documented in the IPCC reports?
No. In fact, in a number of cases, we are ahead of the global average in some of our impacts, particularly because we sit at that transition with a seasonal snowpack.
And you were asked at the end of cross-examination, if Montana doesn't do anything about unpredictability, is there any unpredictability in your mind that there's going to be more heat and more danger?
It's not a question of if, it's a question of how much, how soon, and how big.
Thank you. No further questions.
No further.
All right. You may step down. You're excused. Thank you.
Thank you.